cool to be.
I'd
decided.
Like us all to be one big community.
Not necessarily the most politically.
I surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life? That
you
much?
Let somebody drill into you.
Hello, it's Talk Show 101. We've picked ourselves up off the floor after last month's sex special, and we're back to business as usual today. And here's Kate with a rundown of what's in store.
You might have picked yourself up, Rob, but my parents certainly haven't. Anyway, in 20 minutes, we'll be chatting with the very funny Alex Brooker. He's one of the stars of Ouch on the Telly, or as Channel 4 likes to call it, The Last Leg.
Ouch on the Telly, yes. Our grapes indeed. 90% of people with learning difficulties have experienced disability hate crime, say the charity MenCap. We'll be digging deep and asking how we can stop it and how quickly that could happen. Journalist Catherine Quarmby and Mike Smith from Real Answers, a disability-led charity, will be here to discuss this with us.
Music by punk band Zombie Crash plays us out, and in mere seconds we're joined by a transport geek and a TV presenter.
So why not stay tuned?
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
It's show 101, everyone, so let's play a quick game of Disability Room 101. Now, Rob, you are a bit grumpy, so I imagine you've got quite a few things that you'd like to put into...
My Disability Room 101.
Yeah, into Room 101. So what's the first thing on the list you'd like to banish?
So many to choose from. I think that the general lexicon of being termed brave or special or whatever I do, somehow it doesn't get me down. I think that kind of behaviour would definitely be in there.
I'm pretty sure you're not brave or special. Sure,
I'm neither of the above.
No,
as
you're definitely not happy about anything.
Too well. I'm delighted about so many things. It just rarely happens when I'm within Broadcasting House, that's all. I'd also want to put in organised fun, annoying positivity. I think is the case today that when you do see people with disabilities on the telly, they're always overcoming something. And I just want to see more chain smoking, drug taking misanthropists who happen to be disabled.
So you just want to see more of yourself on the telly, basically?
Frankly, yeah. Yeah, but what? It's still too positive. I don't think there's anything
brave.
Wrong.
I am special.
Why can't
don't
we have disabled people who
me.
Are horrible, really unpleasant individuals? I want to see a bit more of that. Well, what about you, Kate?
For me, I'm going to put in, I think probably people who walk fast. I want everyone to go at a slow, steady pace, just like me.
Which makes me wonder why on earth you're choosing to live in London.
Well, exactly.
Wouldn't a small village in Belgium be more?
No, I want to live in London, but can I just put everyone else who lives here into Room 101?
I see. I didn't realise Room 101 had that kind of capacity.
It does. Mine does. Mine definitely does. And then also those flipping milk cartons that I can never get the tops off.
That's got nothing to do with your disability.
It does, because my hands aren't quite, you know, they're not very, they're really small and fiddly and, it just annoys me. Oh, my dear. Anyway, we've got some lovely guests here.
I think you've just heard sniggering.
I think they've been giggling away.
Either contemptuously or in support. Was it one or the other?
It was in support.
Thank you very much.
Well, that there is the voice of the lovely Nikki Fox, who I am sure you will all know from shows like How to Look Good Naked. Hi, Nikki. How are you?
Hello. Lovely. I'm good, thank you. Lovely to be here.
And we've also got Christiana Link. Hello, Christiana.
Hi.
And you are a London-based journalist and self-confessed transport and technology enthusiast.
I am.
Is an enthusiast another word for geek?
It is definitely. I'm a geek.
Okay, good. Good. As long as we've got that clear. So you're both here to help us be chatty and topical. Let's kick off with Christiane. Other than benefit cuts, what have disabled people been protesting about in London this month?
Oh, disabled people were protesting against Crossrail because, unfortunately, seven of the Crossrail stations would have step-free access, which I think is just not okay. They should make them accessible as well as the rest of Crossrail.
But isn't that illegal these days anyway, to build something new, which has no disability access at all?
That is a very interesting question. The problem is they're using old stations for the Crossrail network. These are not the stations which will be newly built. These are the old stations which are already there.
Oh, so this is a bit of a loophole that they've been trying to exploit by saying they're not actually new stations.
Basically, they're saying officially they don't touch the stations. We just let Crossrail using them. But that's, I'm sure that's actually not true. And it wouldn't be so expensive to make the station accessible. And everybody's talking about sustainability and making our project sustainable. And I think in 2013, or even then, 2019, to have a brand new transport system which has seven stations which are not accessible is not very sustainable.
And Crossrail is a project to join up London from one side to another with train stations. Is that, have we not got enough train stations? What is Crossrail?
Crossrail is kind of a high speed network connecting part of southwest London and southeast London.
So why is it important for disabled people to be able to access the transport network? I mean, you know, don't we all have cars now?
Kate, really? What an appalling thing to say. Kate,
yeah.
Sustainability Monaghan there, ladies and gentlemen.
Look, I love my car. I'll take it everywhere.
I think you never tried to drive into central London. Yeah, it's not on. And a lot of older people, by the way, can't use their cars anymore, and not every disabled person is driving. And I think if you want to access a lot of areas in life, leisure, go to work, the government wants to put more disabled people into work. So how should they reach basically their offices and workplaces if they can't use public transport? So if you want to make this country accessible, a system like Crossrail must be accessible, I think.
And Nikki, you avoid public transport. Why is that?
I'm like you, Kate. I drive everywhere, which is good because it means I'm not an alcoholic. I don't drink. So I drive everywhere and it's brilliant. But like, say for today, for instance, my PA, who I have with me for work occasions, is on holiday having a little sunbathe right now. And so I had to get here, and I had to get here by a cab, accessible cab. And I live about 50 minutes away, so it's really quite pricey. And it would have been great if I could have hopped on at my local train station. But I actually did that journey from my last Radio 5 Live doc, and I couldn't have done it if I wasn't with somebody. Some of my work is going to be taking place at the new BBC studios in Manchester. So I'm going to go there. And I can drive, but it is about 4 hours. And I wanted to get a train because I thought, I'll try it out, I'll get a train, see what it's like. And they wouldn't even let me book the train because I was in a four-wheeled mobility scooter. They said to me, you've got to be in a three-wheeled mobility scooter. I said, I've got a three-wheeled mobility scooter and it's called the Rascal 600 Turbo. That'll give you an idea of the size.
So it's called a Rascal
600 Rascal Turbo. I mean, it's mahoosive.
Can you get one that's also called a pest? Nuisance.
A pain in the bum.
Yeah.
They were only scared that you are quicker than the train.
Well, there we go, you see, Christiane.
And have you noticed that when you look at a Transport for London map of the tube, it actually looks like there's disabled ghettos? Because the ones, the stops that are disability accessible have got a little round wheelchair sticker on them, haven't they? And there's nothing in central London at all except King's Cross.
You can travel from one end of London to the other.
But you can't stop in the important
bit. You can't go in the middle.
And then right out in the east, in Docklands, there's wheelchair stickers everywhere. So it's like, do I have to live in Canning Town? Is this really essential? Is this what you're trying to make me do?
That's exactly the reason why I moved from Ealing to southeast London at one point. When I decided to stay in London, the first thing I thought is, okay, I have to move house because to live in West London is just a no-go area for me. If you want to use public transport, I have to move to the southeast to be able to use the Jubilee line.
And to the great joy of Londoners and to the utter indifference of everybody else listening, and we should probably point out that it looks like the protesters are going to get their way, doesn't it?
Well, we'll see. We still don't have the OK from the Department for Transport saying they are funding the additional stations which are to be made accessible. Boris Johnson more or less promised that Crossrail will be accessible, but he is not the guy with the money. He needs an agreement from the Department for Transport, but they have another 5 years. So I'm personally very optimistic that this is going to work. It's just a matter of will. And within the budget, it's only 0.2%. Crossrail costs 14.5 billion. And to make
so
more,
this is penny change out of their budget, really. But that wasn't the only transport victory, we should also point out, for disabled people this month. A chap called Doug Pawley took First Bus Group to court after a pushchair in the wheelchair space left him unable to board. Now, the company had to pay Pawley, check this, $5,500 and were given 6 months to change their first come, first served policy. His lawyer described the result as a breakthrough. Surely, cases like this, Nikki, this has got to stop you shying away from public transport, even with the rascal.
It has, hasn't it? I've just got to bite the bullet. Shall I tell you, this is my idea, okay, guys? I'm giving it to you first.
Okay, for free?
For free.
Excellent.
Everything I do is for free. I'm not at that stage, you know. I think we should challenge Boris Johnson, that I've been after doing this for ages, right, to sit on my spare mobility scooter. I'll even give him the rascal 600 turbo. Me and Boris can get out there in London on public transport and he can see for himself what it's like.
Yeah. The gauntlet has been laid down.
Come on, Boris. Can you imagine our little blonde hair blowing in the wind on our little matching mobility scooter?
And we know the Mayor of London does like to listen to the Ouch Talk show.
Well, so. Hello, Boris. Do it, babe. It'll be good fun. When I spoke to Maria Miller, who was the Minister for Disabled People, she was saying before the Paralympics that she had tested out the route. And I said to her, did you test out that route with a disabled person? And she said, oh no. And I was like, would you like me to go with you, babe?
I'm pretty sure, I think Boris would be pretty up for that myself. I think he's, he's game for a laugh, isn't he?
Game for a laugh. I hate the way we have to describe our mayor as being some sort of game show contestant.
When I came here this morning, I had actually a twin buggy in a bus. And the mother was arguing with the bus driver if she's able to get on the bus. And the buggy didn't even fit through the door. Wow. So, that is an issue with
challenges buggies. Lay ahead. Now, Indeed. This is the part of the programme where I know all of you are thinking, Rob, what do you think about theme park queues? Well, do not fear. We're about to address this. And so it's long been said that being able to skip these massive queues at Disney World, Disneyland, it's a major benefit of being disabled. But Disney has announced that it's all going to stop. So what's going on here? Can you feel the sadness?
Gosh. Can I just say, this is the only benefit I have of my disability. The only good thing about my disability is skipping the queues at Disney. It is one joy I have in life, and now they are ripping it away from me. They are taking my only joy away.
Oh, calm down.
Somebody
do
this to me.
How often do you go to Disney?
I have an annual pass to Disneyland Paris. I love it. And I live right next to St Pancras. I get on the train, an accessible train, and I get on it at St Pancras. I then wheel off the other end. I'm straight in the park at Disney. It is the best thing in life. And they are taking it away from me, Rob.
So
do you not understand the pain of this?
Let's just bypass Kate's entirely neutral and disinterested stance for a moment. And can either of you to enlighten us as to why, what's actually going on here? Why are Disney stopping this?
This is because... Now, listen, I've only ever been on the vampire ride, Kate. That is as far as the fox has gone. I'm terrified. I was saying to Christiane, I'm useless. But if you were to be a Disneyland regular, you were able to skip the queues and you were able to take about 6 people with you.
Yep.
Fabulous.
Amazing.
Disney are changing the rules because they uncovered the fact that wealthy New Yorkers were paying disabled people to go with them and skip the queues.
I love this. I'd known this, this is a whole new income stream.
Hang on, how much were they charging?
Those quiet disabled months, you could have charged, get this, babes, £649 a day to be a disabled black market Disney guide. Not only would I love
Amazing.
That title, what did you do? Oh, I was a disabled black market Disney guide. Now, in TV, I was telling Kate, it does get a little bit quiet over the summer months when everyone goes on holiday. If I'd known...
Rubbish, I don't see Brucey down the Labour Exchange.
Well, it does for me, baby. But if I'd known, £649 a day.
I know, exactly. You know, this is my dream. I could just... I would literally spend my whole year in Disneyland.
I think, in fact, we should all tender our resignations immediately and head to Paris to cash up on this before the laws are actually implemented. Got a little bit of time, Blake?
We haven't got much time, babe. I think they're changing them in October. 9th of October.
Yeah,
right, well, that
left.
Was show 101. We have to leave you now.
We're off.
I mean, Eurostar. What else do we get? So we can be paid to help other people skip the queues. Is there anything else in life that we as disabled people get preferential treatment over that we can charge out, you know, to rich people who want it? The only thing I can think of is that we get to board the plane first.
And why would you want to do that? I want to be the last one on.
And you leave the plane last, so that's not really...
Exactly. Is there anything else? Is there anything else?
Buy one, get one free gig tickets. I mean, we do get quite nice little platforms.
Cinema, buy one, get one free. Yeah, the disabled platform at Glastonbury is extremely useful.
And we were at a concert, Ben Howard, I think it was, my sister, who's also disabled and a lot less... which is more straight to the point than me, shall we say.
Wowzers.
And three non-disabled people shouted out, oh, let us sit with you. Let us come up onto your platform. My sister was like, naff off.
Surely she should have said, it'll cost you.
Tenner a time, yeah, and you can have it.
In hindsight, yeah.
Is there anything else, though? I can't imagine... there's lots of things that I profit from, like having a Freedom Pass and, you know, a disabled rail car.
I'd rather have a queue jump. I'd rather have a queue jump than a Freedom Pass.
I find that astonishing.
Seriously.
You're prepared to exchange free transport throughout our great city for quicker access to a log flume.
Yeah, for sure. And also, all my friends want to come with me. Maybe that's why they're my friends. Maybe I don't have friends.
Have you been getting used?
Yeah, maybe they just want me for my queue jump. And now if that is taken away from me, that'll be it.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is a good thing about being disabled. Hello. We went to a Ministry of Sound 90s discos anthem. I've still got the glow stick on my scooter right now. And we stayed in a pod. They're basically like this big, massive sort of... You know the things that they put on lorries? They put on ships, containers.
They're like
a massive container. And we got there, and because I had a disabled one, it was, I am not joking, 7 times the size of a normal one. There you go.
That's true. You do get bigger hotel rooms and things, don't you, as well?
Massively oversized toilets. If you get one toilets. At all,
then you get a bigger one.
Comedians are literally going to lose their punchlines for most of their gags, because don't they all say...
Have you ever seen a disabled comedian who doesn't do
exactly.
the skipping the queue theme park?
Yeah, you just say, well, you know, I've got my blue badge. It means I can skip the queue at Disney, and that's going to be gone.
So thanks a lot, Disney. You're putting hard-working comedians who like plagiarising stale material out of work. I rest my case.
Well, all
of us are extremely unhappy, but thanks to Disney, we're now slightly more equal than we were before. And aren't we all just delighted about that?
All but me. Anyway, thank you for joining us, Nikki and Christiana.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
Ouch. Talking disability.
Do you think that your depression would have taken a different form if you weren't someone in the public eye?
You've got to stop saying stuff like this. You really do, because people don't hang themselves because they had a TV show on BBC 4. This is really feeding the stigma. This is like laughing at somebody with cancer and saying, come on, do some Scottish dancing.
bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Stand by for a burst of music. That is Rock and Roll Explosion by punk rocker Zombie Crash. You'll hear it in full at the end of the show, and that certainly will get you going.
Our next guest is one of the few disabled presenters with a steady job on primetime television, and what a depressing sentence that is. We first saw him in the run-up to London 2012 when he interviewed David Cameron and Boris Johnson. Boris is all over the show today, isn't he? Live on Channel 4.
I've noticed you've gone a bit more cockney, Rob, just to try and fit in with
Alex.
Yeah, anyway, since then he's co-presented.
From the north,
yeah, I've gone slightly more disabled to fit in with this show. I'm going to start complaining about my leg in a minute.
You're disabled enough. Promise.
I think you're all right. Yeah. Anyway, Alex has co-presented 3 series of topical comedy show The Last Leg with Adam Hills and Josh Widdicombe. So anyway, we've already heard from you, but a formal welcome to the show, Alex. How are you doing?
Thank you.
You've only been famous for about 12 months. What were you up to before you got your big break?
Before... I joined Channel 4. I used to be a football journalist. Yeah, sports journalist, mainly concentrating on football, you know, doing written and online stuff. I went to uni, did a journalism degree, then I did the sport because I wanted to get paid to watch football. But after a while, working every weekend and Christmas, this makes you hate the game. So when I applied for Channel 4, I was just literally applying for any job I could see.
You actually had football burnout.
Yeah,
fatigue.
It was. It can... When you're subbing Scottish Division 3 team news... On a Friday morning, it's just like, oh,
so
this
are you
is
saying
not
you didn't
game.
You didn't really want to work for Channel 4? You just didn't want to work at weekends.
So almost,
it was just like whatever comes along to not work at weekends. That's what I'm going to do.
Basically, that was it. But I mean, I almost didn't apply for Channel 4. I mean, I had to send in an audition video when I saw the advert. Also, as well, the advert said, you know, are you disabled? I was like, oh yeah. That's quite a good start. You know, do you have a background in sports? I was like, oh, yeah. Do you have a journalism background? I was like, boom. There can't be that many of us knocking about. This is a niche area. I've got half a chance here.
But yet you still almost didn't apply.
But I still
was
almost didn't apply.
Was that pure laziness or you thought the whole project might be awful?
My friend was filming my 3-minute audition video and he couldn't do it one of the days. And he went, look, I can do it Tuesday afternoon and the deadline was the Tuesday night. And I was like, well, I don't know whether I can be bothered. I don't even know if the script's that funny because I'd written like a funny script. And in the end, I just said, oh, I'll do it anyway. Like, it was just on his lunch break when he filmed it for me. But if he'd have said, I'm not free, then I never would have applied.
Was there anything about the disability aspect that kind of put you off and you thought, oh, actually, maybe I don't want to be pigeonholed in that way, so I just want to stay as a sort of mainstream sports reporter?
Do you know what? It's quite strange because that was November 2010. And in March 2010, so it's not that long before, I did a report for the company I was working for on the Paralympics GB Talent Days. And I went along and tried a load of sports and I got talent spotted to go into the rifle shooting team. And then I was put on the squad and my company supported me all the way through. But then I quit. And the reason I quit is because actually I've always grown up, I've never had any other disabled mates. There weren't that any disabled people at my secondary school. So it's quite weird to suddenly find myself pigeonholing myself as disabled. It's really strange and I had a real issue with it. I had to go into, I don't mind talking about it because I've spoken about it before, I had to go into like counselling and all sorts.
So what made you go into counselling? What made you...
Do you know what? I suddenly became very self-conscious. So what was I in 2010? Oh, I was like 26. Never felt self-conscious before, but until I was pigeonholing myself in disabled competition.
So it was when you were surrounded by other disabled people, you suddenly felt self-conscious rather than when you were growing up in mainstream.
Yeah, and it's really, and that's a really strange way to go about it. Like my mum and dad couldn't get their heads around it. They're like, well, why now? You're 26. You've gone through your whole life, and then now you're suddenly starting to get conscious. And I really was, but in fact, actually, that whole process I went through is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Because there's no way I could be doing the job that I do now if I hadn't have had to go through that to feel completely comfortable with myself.
And didn't you make a documentary about self-image and how you feel about yourself?
Yeah, and that was this year. And that was more to do with weight loss. But the end result of it is that now is the best that I've ever felt about myself. And a couple of times in the documentary, I get very emotional when I think back to the place I was at, say 5 years ago, with how I felt about myself to where I am now. And the reason I get sad when I thought about it wasn't because I was ashamed of it or anything like that. I just wish that I could go back and say to myself, hang on a minute, mate, you're all right here.
So what actually helped? What was the turning point for you?
It started with the counselling, and doing the television stuff has helped infinitely. And I'd probably say that the Paralympics, that was probably the best part of it, because I kind of got inspired by it as well. But doing our show, it was almost like you do therapy on telly. I'm talking about my leg, I'm talking about all manner of stuff and having fun with it. And people were embracing it and they were saying how great it was. And that was kind of, yeah, it was weird. It was therapy on a sofa, albeit joined by Josh and then with Adam hosting.
And the weight loss thing's quite interesting as well, because often you see people who have lost a dramatic amount of weight and you can look at them and say, yeah, I can tell you used to be a bit overweight. But I'm looking at you, you don't look like someone who's ever been overweight in your life.
I was, oh mate, I was porky.
Well, no, you were sitting in football grounds eating pies, I imagine, most of the time.
I had like, with my legs, I started playing football when I was a teenager, like really getting into it, but it caused all manner of problems, you know, with my prosthetic and with my disabilities, kind of my mobility wasn't good. I made it worse by playing football, and I had to have loads of operations when I was towards my late teens. And I got really fat because I couldn't use crutches. So I just kind of go in a wheelchair for 4 months while my legs healed. And all I did was eat and play FIFA and stuff like that, and
which is actually not too dissimilar.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when I first got diagnosed, I used to be really sporty, and then about 16, 17, just it all went away, and I just sat at home and ate.
And I think it's something to do with the physical posture. Obviously, I'm not a wheelchair user myself, but when I see people, I just think, look at your lap and look at the chair. That's like the exact dimensions of a tea tray. I could just have a tray of food on me all the time and never stop. I mean, I don't know. Am I talking nonsense?
No, it's, and I was just...
You're built for eating when you're sitting in a wheelchair.
You are talking such rubbish, Rob.
I was eating all the time.
Get your average tea tray full of a few sausage rolls, bit of cake.
I don't know when the last time you've been in a wheelchair, but that is not...
You're saying you can't... When you're in your wheelchair, you could fit a tea tray full of food on your lap.
No, my wheelchair's quite compact. I'm quite small now. I don't need that. So, no. Pipe down, Cosmo. Anyway, back to you, Alex.
Back to me. I'm the guest here, mate.
Let's talk about the last leg. I think we've actually got a clip here.
And the thing is, you don't have to look that far to find someone affected by a dodgy ATOS assessment or disability assessment in any sense. Alex, you've had it.
No, Alex is disabled.
No, I know. But it's just like, you know, I got a letter through.
Yeah.
So, like, in 6 months, they're going to reassess me because my condition might improve. And I think I might have got the wrong end of the sixes. I've been getting excited. I mean, I've been going out buying gloves all week.
So good, it's a very gags. Different sort of show, isn't it, to a lot of the kind of worthy, slightly dull disabled programming of the past.
We were talking about like some other serious stuff though. It wasn't just gags about gloves. I mean, there was stuff about, you know.
But people obviously like that sense of levity that the show brings, as well as the serious stuff. I mean, is that what helped? Do you think it become such a success?
Yeah, definitely. The way we started in the Paralympics was very different. Kind of show to what it is now, obviously, because we were every day. What I loved about Last Leg during the Paralympics is, first and foremost, like, people remember it for the jokes, which is great, but before that it was a celebration of how well things had gone during the day. And it wasn't always just British athletes, but it was talking about how good the sport was first and foremost. And that's what I loved about it, because it wasn't patronizing or anything like that. But then obviously, with the kind of the Is It OK hashtag, and the fact that you had myself and Adam there ready to talk about, happy to talk about all manner of stuff, it kind of enabled us to go places which I must say I've not seen on television before. What I love as well is that even though we were taking a mickey a little bit, and, you know, it was jokes, but there was always an innocence to it all the time. It's never offensive. I mean, people say, oh, it's quite hard, you know, how do you know what's offensive and what's not? If you say something, you think to yourself, that's offensive, then chances are you're going to say something offensive.
I mean,
and there was me thinking it was going to be so convoluted. Yeah. Seems quite simple, makes sense to me.
Well, how far can you push things, and where do you think you you draw the line, especially with the Is It OK hashtag? And how do you decide?
I suppose in terms of what you can and can't say to say people, I mean, when you know them, I think it's the same as anybody. It's anything goes. When you know somebody within, because you know somebody as a person, so you know what you can take the mickey out of them for, whether it's their hair or anything like that, or their exes, mates know the line. And that's the same with any disabled person, whether you're taking the mickey out of their disability or not. But don't go up to a disabled man on the street that you don't know and then start laying into him. Not physically, obviously, I mean, but like with
jokes. But this
jokes
wasn't
and
this.
Like
a, is it okay? You actually had. Yeah. Saying, is it all right to hit a disabled person because they're annoying me?
Yeah, that is. That
and what was your response to that?
Well, first of all, I was upset because that was set in by my mum. No, I wasn't. You got to do these things with reason. I mean, apply some common sense to it, and you should be okay. But my favourite Is It Okay that we had during the Paralympics was someone said, is it okay to chop my right hand off so I can go to the Rio Paralympics? And it's just like, there's more to it than that. I mean, you can't just rock up to Rio Airport, show your right hand missing and go, so what sport do I get? It's kind of, you have to train and stuff like that. And
although isn't that what you did with the rifle team? You just kind of rocked up and...
Do you know what? I regret not following it through a little bit. Obviously now, with the way my career's gone, I wouldn't have had time for it anyway, but I look back now and rifle shooting's the best I've ever been at one single thing straight away. I mean, you may look at me on television and think, this guy's slick, he's good. He's taken
exactly
to this really quickly.
Thought, yeah.
It's been a year. He's smooth. But no, rifle shooting's the best I've ever been at anything.
And I mean, it seems that you can enlarge what is okay. If you're doing two things, if you're like you do on the last leg, A, you're being quite playful about it, and B, you're doing it with an air of confidence and swagger. There's no victimhood about it. And I think if you're talking in that way about disability, it seems that you're able to maybe take a few more chances and be a bit edgier than if you were being rather solemn about it.
Definitely. And as well, me and Adam are disabled, so we could go basically where we wanted. But for Josh, I don't think Josh gets enough credit for what he did during the Paralympics, because for him, as a fairly kind of young comedian as well, going into that sort of atmosphere, making the jokes and being in that banter which me and Adam had, it was a very difficult job. And I think he found what I love about our show is that we found the chemistry very quickly. And Josh knows the line as well. And he's not disabled, he just knows the line. And that's why it worked. I mean, we couldn't have had somebody going off too far, do you know what I mean?
But you did have some extremely difficult subject matters to cover. I mean, the most obvious one being the case of Oscar Pistorius.
Yeah.
And it seems that quite a lot of people contacted the show to say how pleased they were with how you handled
that. It's the most we've ever had on on any subject, the most tweets we've ever had on any subject. Because obviously, people saw what we did in the Paralympics and they must have thought, they're going to go to town on him here. And it was never really going to be the case because you didn't know all the subjects. Because there's legal matters as well. I've never had so many lawyers. I've never had a lawyer brief me before going on to the show as much as what
it can had. Kill the humour element slightly.
Yeah, and it's kind of, in the end, it was just like, so can I say this? No. Can I say this? No. Shall I say that? No. What I liked about it is that we never did jokes on the subject, but there were funny questions that arose out of the subject, such as, would he be allowed his legs in prison? And then that got me and Adam into a conversation about what situations we have our legs on and off in. Do I have my leg on in the shower and stuff like that? And that's what I was happy to do because it's not taking a mickey out of what is an absolute tragedy, but...
And we need to make clear that we're talking about Oscar Pistorius allegedly shooting his girlfriend at the time.
Not the tantrum he threw when he lost the... 100 metres to Alan
Oliveira. Oh, we're perfectly entitled to say whatever we want about that.
Something else as well, just on the Paralympic sprinting. The amputee sprinting categories in the Paralympics at the moment are incredible. I've never seen Paralympic sport raised to such a level where you've got literally like five or six people who go into a race that can win. Mm. Like I went to the anniversary games, you've got Johnny Peacock and Richard Brown and Alan Oliveira, and it's just like, it's real elite sport. It's brilliant. And that's the best thing for the Paralympics.
They are all coming through as role models for young people now. Do you think you're coming through as a role model and somebody for young disabled people to look up to?
Quite a lot of times when I go to like charity events and I get a lot of tweets and it's from disabled people saying that they look up to me and I'm just like, I mean, you must be devoid of role models if you've turned to me. I mean, but it's nice and it's great because I didn't have anybody like that so much when I was younger. I mean, when I was like 11 or 12, I mean, I didn't really know that many disabled people like on television. There were very few. It's only people really like kind of Addy and Tanny Gray and people like that. They were the ones who are kind of you'd look up to, but they weren't the role models now. Like people like Johnny Peacock and, you know, stuff like that. The Paralympics has borne out these heroes. And for people, when they say to me, oh, you're a bit of a role model, it's great. It's the best thing. It's the best compliment I could be paid. Obviously, other than that, I'm funny and also fairly good looking as well, which is a nice compliment.
Do you have a role model yourself? Do you have one?
What?
Do you have a role model?
Not. So, I mean, mine are footballers though. So, but they're not disabled role models. My disabled role model is Alex Zanardi, who's the Italian hand cyclist, and the reason it is because he just like people don't know his story. He was a Formula One driver and then he went into another form of motor racing, lost both his legs at the knee in the crash, and then he went on to win like two gold medals in hand cycling at the Paralympics last year. And for me, it just kind of, I don't know, it very rare now. I'm 29 and I thought I knew all I could about my disability and how I feel about it. And then I did an interview with him at Brands Hatch for a preview piece for Channel 4. And the way he spoke about disability, I've never heard anybody who has gone through such, I don't know, such like a trauma, but it's got such a brilliant attitude towards it. I mean, it made me feel bad. I mean, I moan about blisters on my leg. Like the other day, I was saying to my missus, it's like man flu. Like leg blisters for me are like man flu. It's like you blow it all out of proportion. You go on about it for ages until no one really cares. And I was moaning about that, and it made me feel quite humble.
Well, last leg is back in January 2014, and so we'd like to say to you, Alex, golden shot, Brooker. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Cheers. Thanks. Thank
you. Ouch. Talking disability.
I put myself on a dating site once and I didn't mention that I had a disability, and I got loads and loads of emails asking for dates and stuff. Obviously, I had to tell them I had a disability, and then there was just like no more emails. I put myself on as having a disability and I just didn't get any emails whatsoever, so I think it is very image-orientated.
bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Francesca Hardwick, Michael Gilbert and Kevin Davies are all names you may have heard in the headlines in recent years. They all died as a result of what is now thought to have been sustained abuse due to being disabled, a disability hate crime.
Crimes aggravated by disability prejudice are said to be underreported, but it's estimated that there are hundreds of thousands of victims who remain silent.
And here to tell us more are Catherine Quarmby, author of the 2011 book Scapegoat, Why We Are Failing Disabled People, and Mike Smith, director of Real Answers, a disability-led charity in London's Tower Hamlets, and co-author of two reports on disability hate crime for the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Let's start this off by hearing from someone who has experienced this problem. Neil has learning difficulties. He regularly gets called spastic and retard because of how he looks and speaks. In this clip, he talks about when everything came to a head.
I seen doors and bang, bang, knock, knock. And I thought, bloody hell. When out my front door, no one there. I went, who is it? All of a sudden, this boy come over the fence, screaming past me. He said, yeah, what do you want? What do you want? And all that, bloody accusing me of this, accusing that. And I sort of forced the door shut because he was trying to get in. And about 11 o'clock, quarter past, knock on the door. All of a sudden, this bloke come round the corner from out of sight, massive bloke he was. He knocked seven bells out of me, knocked me to the ground, my glasses, everything.
Now, Neil does have learning difficulties, and what I'd quite like to know is, Catherine, is it more likely that somebody with learning difficulties is going to be a victim of this kind of crime?
As opposed to other disabled people?
As opposed to a wheelchair user or visually impaired person, yeah.
I mean, it does seem from the statistics we've got so far, it does seem that people with learning difficulties do seem to be targeted for longer periods. And in some ways, one might also say groomed by so-called friends. And this has come to be called mate crime, which is not a very nice term, but kind of describes people being targeted by so-called friends. Having said that, you know, wheelchair users also get attacked a lot. So do people with autism and so on. So we don't really know because the statistics are still being compiled. But I do think that people with learning difficulties get targeted in a particular kind of way.
And Mike, what's been your experience of this?
OK, so when we did the research on this, we found that actually there just wasn't enough evidence to get a clear pattern because forces aren't recording different impairment types properly. As well as learning disability, people with mental health conditions often get targeted. But in fact, there's a really wide spectrum and people with all kinds of impairments are targeted, and particularly people with dual equality strands. For example, you're black and you're disabled, or you're gay and you're disabled. We're often particularly sought out for targeting. What we do know, though, is that the massive underreporting clearly doesn't tell a true picture. And forces like the Metropolitan Police, who've been doing quite a lot of work to get the reporting numbers up, are actually seeing a much broader range of impairment types coming through on increased reporting. So I think, actually, the answer is we need to do more work to find out, really, what the real spread is.
And has there been much research as to why this idea of mate crime exists? What prompts an able-bodied person to befriend a person with a disability and then abuse and exploit them, either mentally or physically or both? Do you have any insight into this?
I mean, we're still waiting for the first perpetrator analysis work to be published, in fact.
Well, what's your opinion, though? What would you say it could possibly be down to?
Mate crime specifically?
Yes.
Well, in the cases that I looked at in Scapegoats, and obviously that was just a small number of cases, you saw people being targeted. I mean, often actually men being targeted by women, which is quite unusual for hate crime. So it wasn't the same as other forms of hate crime. And it would start off as sort of one form of crime and evolve over time, which was unusual as well. So you might start off, targeting someone perhaps for money. And this is something that Mike and his team also identified at the Equality Commission. It was kind of cuckoo crimes, I think you called it, where, you'd start off kind of robbing someone of medication and money, but that would evolve into something much more sinister over time. So the motivation itself can vary over time.
I know this is something Kate's got experience of. We were talking about it before we started recording the show today. And I think that I thought it was an incredible and shocking story that you told, Kate.
Yeah, it was a friend of mine who started university and he was put into a flat with people, and he has a form of autism. And it started by them saying to him, you know, oh, I think you should give us a tenner, let's go down to the cash point. And it turned into every single day they were walking him to the cash point and getting him to get out 20 quid. And they said, we need it for you to live here with us. We need it for alcohol. It's your share of the food bill. And eventually his parents found out, and they looked at his bank statement, and every day he was being taken advantage of for, you know, 10, 20, 30 quid at a time. And it started out of them just sort of trying it out and seeing what happened. And it turned into this kind of sustained theft. And I just, you know, I just did not know what to do. I mean, what would...
But they got away with it, didn't they?
As far as I know, but what should we be doing about this?
Before we come to what we do, can I just pick up on the general point about make crime, which is, whilst it's really helpful term for some people to understand what's happening to them and to relate to what's happening to the hate crime, I think it's quite important for people at large to, or policymakers in particular, not to focus on that terminology, because it kind of implies that some disabled people are just not capable of making friends on their own. And what the last thing I want is a protective state coming over and sort of modelling, coddling everyone. And there are other kinds of crime, whether it be sexual abuse crime or targeting immigrant workers in some ways. You know, if someone's, it's about power politics and about who's able to influence power and affect it, and who's on the other side. And there are lots of situations of that in different sorts of crime.
For example, I just think
it's important to get the perspective right.
It is, but as somebody who looked onto this and understood it was happening, what steps should we be taking from the outside to try and do something about it?
Okay, well, there's a whole range of things you can do. For example, you can help the individual, your friend, understand what's happening to them, because lots of people just didn't realise that what was happening to them was hate crime. They just thought it was part of the day-to-day reality of living life as a disabled person. You can help them report it to the police. There are third-party hate crime reporting schemes all around the country. There are other organisations. There are national phone lines that you can do to report them. If you're really concerned about someone's safety, you can help report to social services as well. There's a whole range of things, but people do need to take action.
Let's go back to Neil's story. Let's hear another clip that we found particularly moving.
I do have the minor flashback. Sometimes I'm just sitting down and just going to trance and think all about the things that's happened to me back. Well, is this really me? Is this happening to me? Why is it happening to me?
It's important for us to tell you that Neil is in a safe and a better place now. And his story comes from Mencap's YouTube channel. So if you want to see the video in full, there'll be a link to it from bbc.co.uk/ouch. Catherine, that is a clip of Neil sounding like he can't quite understand what's happened to him. Is that an experience that's common?
I think so, because it is very hard to comprehend why you would be targeted in that way. And I think, you know, the successful outcome is one, to feel safe, and two, to feel that you've got some kind of justice. And unfortunately, sadly, that is happening less and less at the moment. You know, the successful hate crime prosecutions fell for the last year, for which we've got figures available. So, in fact, if you go and report now, and more disabled people are reporting, you're less and less likely to get a satisfactory outcome. The reason why I think police are so confused about disability hate crime still, and to a certain extent domestic violence, crimes against women, is that they happen in the home when so-called carers steal from them or abuse them, or so-called friends groom them. If, you know, maybe grooming's a better word, as Mike said earlier, with mate crime, maybe we need to use the word grooming more. So I think that's why we're getting so much confusion about what is a disability hate crime, and that's why police still aren't actually taking those cases forward and getting successful prosecutions.
Well, the National Crime Survey for 2012, it recorded 65,000 disability hate crimes. 65,000. Yet only 1,700 were reported to police, and there were only 621 prosecutions. Now, on the face of it, that doesn't sound very successful. Mike?
I mean, on those numbers, what they're basically saying is that 34 out of 35 crimes don't get reported because people either think that they won't be responded or it can't be responded. And that's borne out time and time again by the wider criminal justice system failing to recognise what's happening as hate crime, failing to investigate it as such, failing to prosecute it as such, and even when it is prosecuted, failing to to get what's called Section 148 uplifts, the penalty for disciplinary crime. So the whole system at the moment is working in a way that doesn't give disabled people confidence to report in the first place, because they're just putting themselves potentially in an even more vulnerable position by making a big deal about it.
So what can be done to bring the disability hate crime figures down?
This does all seem very, irredeemably grim. Is there any hope out there? Can you help us on this level?
Bizarrely, I would rather see the numbers go up to start with, so at least it would focus the authorities' attention that this is a real problem and that they would appropriately apply resources and attention.
Labour has spoken about this problem recently, and I know the government have done in the past as well. Is this something that the government need to be taking charge of?
The thing with this is it's a really, really complex problem. It's ingrained in the way that society understands and values disabled people in the first place, and it's going to take a long time to change the outcomes. When we did our report, the Hidden in Plain Sight report, in 2011, and 1 year later, the Out in the Open report, we came up with a list of about 40 or 50 recommendations for central government, for national organisations, and for local areas as well. And aligned to that on the EHRC website is the action plans that about 40 or 50 national organisations have published to say this is what we are going to do about this over the next few years. The important thing is that everyone needs to read those and understand what they are, so when they're talking to the local politicians or the local council people, they can say, well, hold on, you committed to do this thing, to change this problem.
Well, what have the government actually said? I mean, because we're not all going to be able to read the report, so what are we going to be asking our politicians to do?
Well, the Law Commissioner currently doing a review on whether the legal framework is correct, and the police are doing education and training to their officers on how to understand and recognise better. Social service departments are trying to be more joined up in the way that they recognise and protect and support people to lead equal lives. Housing departments need to think more carefully about where you give disabled people housing to make sure that they're properly supported to be inclusive. And social behaviour teams have to work more thinkingly to look for patterns of behaviour and look for repeat victims. So there's a whole joined up web of solutions that need to happen together.
Catherine?
I would welcome the proposal by the Labour Party to bring in a specific offence. The Disability Hate Crime Network, of which I'm one of the coordinators, that we've just submitted to the Law Commission, saying that we welcome that. I'd like to see aggravated offences in the same way in which we have aggravated offences for racial crimes. I'd like to see the same ones for disability. And now I think there's room for an incitement offence, incitement for disability hatred. I think those things are now, the time is right for those, but we need all those other things that Mike just talked about as well.
Well, it's a fascinating topic and an extremely distressing one, but I thank you so much for your insights into this, both Catherine and Mike.
Thank you.
Ouch. So that's all, folks. Thanks for listening to episode 101. And don't forget to tell your friends about the brilliance of the Ouch Talk Show. You could even share the link on Facebook and Twitter. What a novel idea.
Because I do believe the internet is going to be big.
One day.
This is my prediction.
Yeah. As always, big thanks to the team behind the scenes, Damon Rose, studio manager Phil Hutchinson, and producer Emma Tracy.
And as usual, let's finish with some music. This month, Zombie Crash. They're yet another learning disabled punk band from Brighton. What is going on down there with learning disabled bands? There's literally four that I can think of. But anyway, they're just back from touring the UK, where they shared the bill with a mix of disabled and non-disabled bands. This track from their 2011 album No Mercy is called Rock and Roll Explosion. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Mother head rocking to the last 9 a.m. Hardcore guitar boy.